Good evening, everyone. We are here for meeting number 72 on Tuesday, the 3rd of March 2020, and we're opening our meeting at 5:30 p.m. I welcome everyone who's here this evening. That's councillors, management and members of the public attending the City of Melbourne. We respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Boonwurrung and the Woiwurrung Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and pay our respects to their elders past and present. For the Kulin Nation, Melbourne has always been an important meeting place for events of social, educational, sporting and cultural significance. Today, we are proud to say that Melbourne remains a significant gathering place for all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. I take this opportunity to notify members of the public that this meeting is being streamed live. It will be available through the City of Melbourne's website. An audio and a video recording will also be available on our website by close of business tomorrow. Whilst we do try to avoid filming members of the public who are attending this evening and presenting or asking questions, there is a possibility that your image will appear in the live streaming and the video recording, so please be aware of that this evening. The unconfirmed minutes of this meeting will also be available from the City of Melbourne's website as soon as practicable. Should you have any queries relating to the conduct of this meeting, the documentation or the submission process, please speak with a member of our council business team at the end of the meeting, and we've got Kate and Jody just here to answer any of those questions. Could we all please check that our mobile phones are turned to silent or off so that we have a smooth meeting this evening without interruptions from mobile phones? That would be most appreciated. Thank you. I note that the agenda this evening comprises three reports from management. I'm also noting that we've received apologies this evening from Deputy Lord Mayor Aaron Wood and from Councillor Susan Riley. At the start of the meeting, when appropriate, we make certain statements on behalf of councillors and council, and I have two of those this evening. The first one is to note that at the Future Melbourne Committee held on 3 December, Chris Thrum raised the difficulties currently being experienced in Chile. I know from Chris's comments concerning the City of Melbourne's international engagement, including his many positive letters over a long period of time, that Chris is very well informed on international developments. As a city, Melbourne has always sought to live up to its values and promoted our values with our international partners as being an important part of our identity and the work that we do with those international cities. In saying this, we do need to acknowledge that the conduct of Australia's foreign relations is the responsibility of the federal government. It is the role of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade to manage Australia's international relations and express Australia's view and attitude in response to specific developments. Nonetheless, without referencing specific matters, I would like to make a clear statement that the City of Melbourne's values include respect, which includes respect for all views, and accountability, which includes taking responsibilities for actions. The City of Melbourne is saddened by the loss of life wherever and however it happens. As Lord Mayor of Melbourne, of one of the world's most diverse and inclusive cities, on behalf of our councillors here, we are encouraging everyone everywhere to contribute to harmonious communities through appreciating diversity, equality and equity, cooperation and participation. And we thank Chris Thrum for raising this issue and note that it's taken us a little while to get back to you, Chris, but hopefully that responds to your query and request. We also want to note that this week is the lead up to International Women's Day 2020 on Sunday, 8 March. On behalf of the Council, we wish to recognise the women who have contributed to our community, many of whom are the unsung heroes of our city. This year is the 100th anniversary of the first woman elected to any level of government in Victoria, and that person was Mary Rogers in 1920, elected to the Richmond Council, as it was then. We also want to recognise our groundbreaking first two female Lord Mayors, Leckie Ord in 77-78 and Winsome McCackie in 78-79, part of a council that implemented what is still regarded as one of the most transformation urban renewal policies, Postcode 3000, that changed our city in so many positive ways. We want to recognise all of our female councillors and staff and say thanks for doing your bit to create positive change in our community and here in the organisation that is the City of Melbourne. We also recognise the men who push for fairness, diversity and equity in workplaces. Thank you. International Women's Day gives us an opportunity to recognise the efforts and legacies of women in our society, to understand current barriers and opportunities for more respect and equity of women in our communities today, and to set up platforms and policies to support women into the future, including helping us set a very loud and visual record this weekend at the MCG at the Women's T20, International T20 Final, a world record for the biggest attendance supporting a professional women's sporting match. We're hoping for more than 90,000 people and look forward to seeing everyone there. But ahead of Sunday, happy International Women's Day. I advise members of the committee and the public that where the committee makes a decision on the basis of fewer than six members voting in favour of it, the decision may be referred by a councillor to council for decision. We're at item two of our agenda this evening, which is to note disclosures of conflicts of interest. If any councillor has either a direct or an indirect interest as defined under the Local Government Act 1989 in relation to a matter to be considered by committee, can you please disclose the nature and type of that conflict prior to consideration of the item? Thank you very much. Councillors, we're now at confirmation of minutes of previous meeting and I'm calling on a councillor please to move a resolution adopting the minutes of open meeting number 71 held on Tuesday, 18 February 2020. Councillor Frances Gillie has us underway and a seconder to that motion. Councillor Rees, thank you very much. I'm putting the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. It's unanimous, so I can declare that motion carried. Thanks, councillors. Matters arising, councillors, are there any items you'd like to discuss from the minutes of the last meeting? None, thank you. The following submissions have been received in accordance with the Council's Meeting Procedures Code, and I'll go through each item, the submissions and the request to speak, so please bear with me as we do that. In relation to agenda item 6.1, Ministerial Planning Referral TPMR-2019-24, which is 102 to 156 City Road, Southbank. We've had requests to speak from Tony Penner, Southbank Residents Association, Jamie Govanlock from Urbis, Phil Rowe from Cox Architecture, and Jock Gammon from Junglefy. Did I get that right? That's cool. Look forward to that. Items of correspondence have been received from Tony Penner, Southbank Residents Association. I saw Tony arrive somewhere here. Did I? Yes. Great. In relation to agenda item 6.2, draft affordable housing strategy, we've had requests to speak from Michael Lennon, Housing Choices Australia, Roberta Buchanan from Housing Choices Australia, and from Tony Penner from the Southbank Residents Association. Welcome. We've had items of correspondence from Michael Lennon, Housing Choices Australia, and Tony Penner, Southbank Residents Association. In relation to agenda item 6.3, Planning Scheme Amendment C365, Charterhouse Heritage, we've had a request to speak from Tristan Davies from the Melbourne Heritage Action and Wayne Coles-Janis. We've had items of correspondence from Julie Taylor Bartels, Weng Tuk Yi on behalf of the Yi family, sole owners of Buryaya Developments Pty Ltd, Tristan Davies from the Melbourne Heritage Action, and Wayne Coles-Janis. Thank you to everyone. Now, the way that we work this evening is that as items come up for consideration, we'll be asking our presenters to come up to the podium. Before I do that, was there anybody here this evening that wanted to speak but I didn't call out their name in relation to any item? None. That's excellent. When you do and are called up to the podium, we allow 3 minutes for submissions. And to help you, we have a countdown clock here on the wall. It beeps at 2 minutes to let you know you've got 1 minute left. It beeps again at the end of your time, at which time we ask you respectfully to please take your seat. We would like to try and keep to the time limits if we can. It's fair for everyone. And we appreciate your cooperation in advance. Thank you. Item 5 is public questions. And in accordance with the Council's meeting procedures code, a 15-minute period is provided at the start and at the end of all of our FMC meetings for members of the public to be able to ask questions. Questions should be no longer than 90 seconds in duration, and again, we can use the countdown clock if it's helpful. And I just remind members of the public who do want to ask questions that this is a time for questions. It's not a time made available for submissions about items that are on the agenda. So genuinely encouraging people to be able to come and pose questions to councillors and council staff about items and issues they're passionate about. So if you do have a question, I'm going to ask you to put your name up. I can take names and then we'll ask you to come up one by one to the podium. Do we have, I can see Chris Thrum's hand, I believe. Yes. Chris, anybody else for questions at this time? We do have 15 minutes at the end if you'd like to utilise that. And Chris, it looks like it's you for the start of the meeting. Welcome to the podium. Thank you.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I would say Deputy Lord Mayor, but he's absent tonight. Councillors, men and women of the Kulin Nation, first, thanks for the kind words about Shiloh and the sentiments expressed from the City of Melbourne in regards to respect and living in a harmonious world. And also to this stage, 2 weeks, and say congratulations to the Collingwood Football Club for their pre-season victory over the Richmond Football Club. And I'm sure we're looking forward to more adventures in the coming football season. But I've got some questions in regards to heritage and in regards to the City of Melbourne's approach to the Palace Theatre. I think maybe Councillor Ryan Leppard might be on top of these developments. The City of Melbourne is being pilloried and I think adversely criticised for their role in attempting to save the Palace Theatre. We do know that in November of 2013, City of Melbourne did vote against the application to develop the hotel at that time. And we do know that City of Melbourne went to VCAT to defend the Palace Theatre. That's a fact. I think Rowan Leppard is cognizant of criticism of the City of Melbourne, which I feel is unjustified in many ways. Your thoughts, through you, Lord Mayor, but your thoughts in regards to the Palace Theatre and City of Melbourne's concerted effort to defend and protect it, which they did.
To the Chair of our Heritage Portfolio, Councillor Rohan Lippitt.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. I'll give it a go. Thanks very much, Chris, for the question. I've noticed a fair bit of chatter online as well. I think the reason for that is a recent story in The Age, which was prompted by photos taken of demolition inside the building in the last few weeks. I emphasise that all of that building activity is legal because all of the conditions, the pre-demolition conditions that VCAT imposed in 2017, I believe, have been met, and so that work was legal. But the whole experience, you're right, was a very, very difficult one. The Heritage Council knocked back the application for heritage protection and placing Palace Theatre on the Victorian Heritage Register. That was for a number of reasons which I'd love to go into, but I'd take up the rest of the time of the meeting. It was an unfortunate process, and then the City of Melbourne also considered the matter, and I think that was at the end of 2014, over the course of three different meetings, and the deliberations are a matter of public record there as well. But the main point you made is absolutely right. We defended Council's position at VCAT quite strongly, which was even though we didn't in the end succeed in increasing the heritage grading and status of the Palace Theatre, we did go to the tribunal with a position of opposing the application based on what it was for a variety of reasons, and we put forward Graham Davidson and other heritage experts to defend the position. And so assertions on the public record this week that the City of Melbourne permitted the demolition that's occurring this week are incorrect. And thank you for the opportunity for pointing that out.
In regards to the hearing at, I think, Heritage Victoria, I have to acknowledge that Melbourne Heritage Action have been staunch defenders of the palace in many realms and theatres in this conflict, and the National Trust as well. However, are you cognizant or are you aware that at that meeting to define the category of the palace theatre in terms of state registration of heritage, are you cognizant of the fact that Melbourne Heritage Action and National Trust were absent at that meeting and did not present or submit any evidence at this?
So we're talking early 2014 now, I believe. I think this is the first half of 2014. That is my recollection as well. I think the main reason for that is that the application that went into Heritage Victoria and the Heritage Council for registration of the Palace Theatre was quite a quick and rushed application from the advocates. It wasn't what we'd normally see as an application to Heritage Victoria being a full thematic analysis of the scarcity and the other attributes of the building and exactly what is valued as heritage in that building. And so it was the quality of the application that was the primary reason for the for HV knocking it back. But perhaps by the same token, there wasn't a huge amount of coordination with other heritage advocacy bodies like MHA and the National Trust, and that's just one of many reasons why that process failed. I think the primary one, though, was the fact that we don't recognise... our heritage processes still recognise architectural purity above all else, whereas the thing that makes the Palace Theatre quite significant is the mix of architectural genres over many years, and that has added to the social significance of the place. None of that was able to be recognised through the HV processes, but yes, I was aware of the absences, but I think there are a variety of reasons for it.
I think you're on point in regards to perhaps the coordination. And I think it should be noted too that you, Councillor Owen Leppert, and many councillors were very staunch in doing all that you could to protect the Palace Theatre, and many citizens are aware of that as well. And thank you for your time.
It's very kind. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chris. One of our most active citizens, so thank you for that. Subject to there being any other questions, I'm going to call on Councillor Rees, who's the chair of our planning portfolio, to assume the chair of this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lord Mayor. There are indeed two reports from management for consideration under the planning portfolio this evening. The first of those is agenda item 6.1, which is a ministerial planning referral, TMPR 2019-24. It's for the property 102 to 156 City Road, Southbank. I think most people here are aware of what this project involves and the scale of it, and so I think given that, we might invite Officer Jane Birmingham to give us a short presentation about the officer's consideration of this proposal.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Lord Mayor, councillors and members of the public. Council is being asked to consider an application for 102 to 156 City Road, South Bank this evening. The applicant is Bueller SB Developments. The architect is UN Studio and Cox Architects, and the owner is Bueller SB Nominees Proprietary Limited. I would normally run through what the proposal's for, but we have the planning consultant, the architect, and the landscape architect talking about the project tonight. So what I might focus on is the planning controls and the officer recommendation. Everybody is familiar with the site, the current BMW showroom on the corner of South Bank Boulevard and City Road. It's a ministerial permit application, and the City of Melbourne is being asked to provide its views as a recommending referral authority, together with suggested permit conditions. Officers are supportive of the application, subject to the conditions set out in the delegate report, and I'll run through probably what are the key conditions to draw to your attention. Here's an image of the project. Some of the key conditions to point out are conditions 27 and 28, which relate to ESD. Those are to ensure best practice initiatives are incorporated in a development of this scale and prestige, I guess, given the location. Condition 30, which requires provision of a landscape package, and this is to ensure the viability and maintenance of the proposed building greening. That's a really strong part of those images and a key tenet of the design. Condition 32 requires a public art strategy, which is to ask the applicant to work with the City of Melbourne to develop a site-specific public art strategy for this development. Condition 37 is a very important one. That's the legal agreement that is tying in the public benefits that are required for this development to provide, and those are locking in the office and childcare centre uses for a minimum of 10 years, securing public access to the podium rooftop, which is an area of about 5,000 square metres that will be accessible to the public, although it will remain in private ownership, a financial contribution to the remaining section of the South Bank Boulevard upgrade between City Road and the river, and ensuring that the community conference and entertainment facilities are made available to a not-for-profit entity. And all those matters have been agreed to by the applicant. The final matter, I think, to point out is that at the moment the relevant aviation authority hasn't been provided. The building, or the Eastern Tower, which is obviously the taller tower you can see here, is currently in excess of about 11 metres higher than the aviation air traffic control height, and it's just to note that any changes resulting from the aviation restrictions will require further planning approval, but if it were to be a reduction of 11 metres, there would be no intention to bring it back through this committee. That's a relatively minor change in the scheme of this development. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think there's a question from Councillor Leppett for you, Jane.
Thanks, Jane, and I might ask Jamie for his account as well. I know that the advice in the report is for a potentially CASA or whatever the regulatory body is, I don't work in that space, is for a 10-metre reduction. If the case may be that we need a more significant reduction, how significant do we need to look at before we need a formal application to amend a planning permit should one issue by the Minister?
The urban design advice has come back suggesting that we need to ensure a 50 metre differential between the height of the Eastern Tower and the Western Tower and to maintain the architectural identity of the site. The applicant probably can speak more to the aviation controls, but my understanding is that something in the order of 11 metres or three levels is realistic. If it was any more than that, say 10 levels, for example, it depends what it would do in terms of the development's compliance with, say, DDO 10 and what other changes might be required to supplementary reports, such as wind, what it would do to, shadows would be less, what it would do to the design of the building and perhaps how that might feed into the uplift provisions. So there is a bit of an unknown here. We are assessing the application on what is before us at the present time. But on the best advice of the applicant, who has had quite a number of discussions with the Aviation Authority, we believe it's probably going to be in the order of that 11 metres.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just on that point, I'll just, I guess, flag for our upcoming presenters that I am interested in the event that there is a reduction in 11 metres, are we confident that that will maintain the symmetry of the two twisting towers? So if someone could address that as part of the presentation, that would be appreciated.
Thank you.
If there aren't any further questions, you can resume your seat, Senior Practice Leader Birmingham. Much appreciated. I now call on Tony Penner, who is no stranger to this place. Welcome to Town Hall, Tony, from the South Bank Residents Association. You've requested an opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter. You know the rules, no more than 3 minutes, please.
Got me by surprise. I thought we might have heard from the developer, but never mind. South Bank Residents Association is supportive of this planning application. We think overall it's a great outcome for the community. There's a few little points that we've noted that we've had some slight concerns with in the short time that we've had to review the application, and they are vehicle access on Waterfall Lane behind the development from City Road. We haven't got a development in that spot with quite the traffic that is proposed, and already between Queensbridge Road and City Road at any time of the day, not just peak hours, it is already congested, it is already blocked, and there are already cars beeping, so I'm not sure how you're going to shove a few more in there, and let alone trying to cross two lanes of traffic on the South Bank Boulevard side, which is also pretty busy already. Their concerns, which I'm sure will be considered, we've got some, apparently the planning model, the traffic model says that everything's going to be okay, but I can show you many examples of buildings in South Bank where the traffic model's settling that it was all going to be fine, and hey, once the building's developed, it's quite a different story. Of note, in the renders that we saw from the developer on South Bank Boulevard, we were acutely aware, because we were very involved in the community consultation for the South Bank Boulevard upgrade, there was a basketball court going right there where we see this wonderful forecourt to a what looks like a bar or something. There's no mention of what may or may not happen to that basketball court that was proposed for that space in the City Road upgrade. I did specifically mention during the City Road upgrade that that basketball court may not work with whatever's proposed for that site, and I was told that the site would have to work with the basketball court. So I think there's been a disconnect there with some sort of communication, but I would like the council officers to try and explain to us what's happened to that basketball court. Greening. We note we're very pleased with the degree of degreening across the entire development and the developer's commitment to be a leading development for environmentally sustainable design. Very happy there. There's a lot of talk about the Freshwater Place link, which will bring it into Queensbridge Square. We're 100% supportive of that, and we certainly hope that the other party will work with the developer to get that across the line. The $5 million contribution that we acknowledge the developer did not have to make, have decided to contribute towards that. It will go some way to filling that hole that One Queensbridge Tower didn't, or has left, I should say. Look, overall, this development will offer a great deal of public realm experience for the residents of South Bank and her visitors. We are delighted with the level of detail and consideration which has been applied to this site. Owing to the size of the site, there was a real opportunity for something special, and we feel the developer has met that challenge. We have seen many developments in South Bank over the years, and this development seems to have really considered the public benefit and experience, something lacking in many of the South Bank developments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, as always, Tony. Your questions about Waterfall Lane and the basketball court, I might check at this stage if officers want to respond to those now. Yep. All right, let's try and deal with those now before we get into the presentations from the advocates.
Hi. Through you, Chair, I'll tackle the basketball court first. I believe that that was modelled in the South Bank Boulevard upgrade, and it's adjacent to the subject site but outside the site boundaries. I believe it's been shown in a draft concept plan for that final stage between City Road and the Yarra River, so it's probably something that's going to be subject to further consultation. So I'd say it's not off the table. It's been part of a draft concept, but we'd need to follow that up with the Capital Works team. In relation to Waterfall Lane, Certainly the applicant's traffic engineers and council's traffic engineers have assessed the traffic implications and believe that it's acceptable, subject to a suggested condition requiring a road safety audit to look at the finer details of how it will work in practice. Probably one other point worth noting is that even with the parking overlay in place, this development could provide up to 1,300 car spaces, and there's 249 car spaces proposed, which is about 19% of the maximum allowed under the parking overlay. So I'm reasonably confident that that volume of traffic could be accommodated within the street network.
All right, thank you, Jane. And look, just on the basketball court, that will not be forgotten. Tony Penner, so expect further correspondence from the city and working in this area to see that one through. And thank you for the update around the traffic modelling as well. I now call on Jamie Govanlock from Urbis to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome back to Town Hall, Jamie.
Thank you very much. Excellent. Good evening, Lord Mayor and Councillors. Thank you for the opportunity to present and speak tonight. First of all, I'd like to thank the Council Planning Officers who are in the room tonight, being Richard, Jane and Evan, for their team effort in putting this together and coming up with a fine recommendation. Had ups and downs, but we got there. Let me start by saying that I'm very excited to be involved in a project like this. I'm here often, and to me, when I see that image of the twin, twin towers, it's always more than a building. It's so much more than that to me, and I'll go through the reasons why. I'm very proud to be involved, and I'm very proud to be involved with the clients, because the clients have been very aspirational and easy to deal with, and always dealing with a community good, which is very, very positive. To me, this project's about regeneration or repositioning and the public realm in this South Bank area. The project will play a pivotal and vital role in achieving Council's future vision for the precinct through its alignment and implementation of the City Road Master Plan, the South Bank Boulevard and Dodd Street Concept Plan, and also importantly, Council's new Urban Design Policy Amendment C308, which is probably imminent to sort of come on the books. All of those things talk about improving the public realm, improving pedestrian amenity and greening up this area of South Bank. South Bank for too long, for a range of historical reasons, has been the aspiring relative to the CBD, particularly in relation to land use and particularly in relation to these one-dimensional sort of apartment towers that have sprung up throughout South Bank over the years. It is what it is. It was a different era. We've moved on since then. The public realm needs significant sort of improvement and I think rehashing in South Bank. As you move further away from the river, things don't look too good, and I think we all agree with that. I think this project really repositions this part of the precinct and injects that vitality and that regeneration back into the precinct. And there's a range of reasons why this occurs. And that's really the public benefit that's being put in. We have a tool. I'm not often not critical about DDO10, but I think in this case, DDO10 provides the actual opportunity for true measurement and for this to occur. I know this is going live, but won't believe I'm saying this. But anyway, some of the things. So effectively, you've got 27,000 square metres of office space, a $5 million contribution to the South Bank Boulevard upgrade, and 4,800 square metres of upper level public open space. I know I'm running out of time. There's many other things. The auditorium, child minding centre, public art, the exhibition space, the public conservatory and so forth. These are all additional things. That image up on the screen there talks about the big numbers. There's basically $44 million of additional benefit if we're just looking at the DELWIP guidelines. If we throw the net further, we're looking at a total benefit of $307 million, which is basically well above the minimum benchmark of $137 million. It's a great project. Would you like just that pans up? Question: do you want me to clarify that the building height, aircraft?
Yes, sure. Yeah, this would be a good point to do that, Jamie. Thank you. And maintaining the symmetry between the two towers, particularly the twisting towers.
Yeah. Jane was exactly right. The urban design advice that was provided by the council talks about that sort of minimum symmetry and sort of relationship between the two towers. Currently, the east tower, the tall tower, is 365.1 metres. with the West Tower being 250 metres. It's about 115 metres difference. If you took out the 10 or the 11 metres, and that's proposed to be done through the reduction in plant area height, you'll basically still be able to achieve that symmetry between the two towers. So that's how it would be achieved. My understanding is, through discussions with the aviation consultants, I haven't been dealing directly with the regulatory authorities, it's not my field, but I'm certainly told that 11 metre reduction in the overall building height off tower of the east tower will effectively comply with PANZOPS. In the grand scheme of things, it's a relatively minor change in height when we're talking about a building that's proposed to be 365 metres high. Should this motion be passed tonight and the officer's report supported and so forth, we'd be seeking to negotiate with DELP and also with the involvement of Melbourne City Council officers to insert a planning permit condition to ensure that there is that compliance and that it is the reduction by 11 metres. We wouldn't want to be lodging fresh applications and coming back again. We'd seek to do it under this planning permit, should one be granted.
All right, thank you very much for that, Jamie. Seeing you present, Councillor Leppett.
Thanks, Chair, and thanks, Jamie. Glad to hear you love DD-010. I will concede that it helps when the site in question is over 6,500 square metres.
Yes, indeed.
Just on the PANZOPS question still, I'm not sure if you can answer this question or if anyone else can. If you can't, and I promise you this will have no bearing on the debate or the vote, but sure. When Australia 108 just up the road was chopped back to 317 metres by CASA,
yes.
Why is 355 metres...
365.
After 10 metres is chopped off, 354? Whatever the height is, it's going to be a lot more than 317 metres. Was I right the first time? Yeah, I was right the first time.
Yeah, you were.
Yeah, thank you. Why is it? Is it something about the flight paths? Can you just help me out here? I'm just curious,
right? The short answer is no, because I haven't been dealing directly with it, but I'm told by the aviation consultants who operate in a black box, excuse the expression, that it's okay and the figure's 11 metres.
Excellent pun. Anyone on the front bench care to answer that question, or shall I have to do my homework tomorrow?
We can take it on notice.
Thank you. As I said, no bearing on the debate. No. I'm just very curious. Thank you very much.
It's a good question, Councillor Leppard. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jamie.
Thank you.
All right, I now call on Philip Rowe from Cox Architecture to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome back to Town Hall, Phil.
Thank you. Thank you, Lord Mayor. Thank you, councillors, public. This is a very important project, I think, for all of us, and I'm going to try and get through it in 3 minutes, but I'll do my best. But there is a lot to know about this project, so I'll keep it reasonably high level and please ask questions if needed. As we started this project and the client's aspirations of this project were very high, they started an international design competition to the world to get the best and most innovative architects involved, which really opened up the opportunity, we thought, to bring Melbourne to the map of world architecture, but also world urban design. The competition name was actually called Future Cities. And the purpose of this was to have a conversation around what future cities look like and the density that we were all facing and the issues of density around these projects. There were a lot of issues, I think, within the city of Melbourne particularly, about the mono-use residential towers that were going up that didn't really understand the idea of community. So the focus on community and that idea of a city and a building in a city was very important, and the brief really spoke to this. So this idea of this mixed-use vertical village was a focal point for us particularly, but also for the vision of the client. Importantly, I think in this area and South Bank particularly, that idea of community and building community was a real focus. And looking at the South Bank structure plan, some of the gaps in the market that are provided here, we saw some key attributes that needed to be focused on. Activation, particularly at ground level, but also the project broadly, that idea of neighbourhood amenity, very important within this precinct. public open space and how we use public open space effectively, the integrated integration into South Bank Boulevard, a key and actually a catalyst to some of the ideas that we thought about, and a 24/7 city. So five key elements out of that was a precinct heart, connected and permeable ground plane and neighbourhood, integrated green and sustainable solutions, neighbourhood amenity, and the alignment with South Bank Boulevard. The idea of Melbourne and its relationship with parkland being very important. So how do we integrate that and align that with how we responded to the urban form? The urban form could have been a very solid mass. We broke it into two to create permeability and wrapped that landscape and the vertical boulevard up the building, creating then ultimately that true vertical village of different programs and so many different elements within that. The idea of the civic heart, creating spaces for destination, fresh food markets at ground level, that idea of a community town hall as a part of the space and green spaces on the roof. Activated ground plans, as we talked about, and creating environments that are very transparent, active, and focusing back as much on South Bank as it is internal as it is external. Placemaking, a very important part, and also a catalyst to a cultural hub. And that idea of landscape really being the fundamental part, which is integrated also in terms of sustainability being a focal point. Sustainability as a key, as a basis to how we started the design. Thank you.
Yes, well done, Phil. I know we're about to hear from Jock in a moment around some of the green infrastructure associated with this project, but I'm interested in your take, Phil, as someone looking after the overall architecture and design of the project. If for reasons unforeseen to any of us this evening, the green infrastructure doesn't work, are you confident that the design will still stand as a good design?
Absolutely. The idea of the green spine, we know and we'll hear, obviously, from Jungle Fly about how it will work. But we've also been asked, obviously, by the city to say, what does it look like if the green doesn't work? For various reasons. Water becomes unavailable, for instance. And the nature of this as being a veranda, so the idea of the green spine as much as a veranda as it is a green space, is still relevant within the built form. And we know that either or will still hold water and still be relevant in an architectural sense and in an environmental sense. So we're very comfortable that both can work, but we're 100% committed to making it work.
Councillor Oak.
Just following on from that, and it might be for you or for the next speaker, this isn't also a condition that I'm considering putting on, but I had this conversation with the officers early today, but the City of Melbourne's new green infrastructure rating tool, yep. Green Factor, I'm very excited about it, but it's in the pilot stage at the moment, and it's out for industry to test. And I just think that this would be a fabulous building to test the credentials of your green infrastructure that you're proposing through this very evidence-based Green Factor tool. So I'm not sure if you've got a view on whether that would be possible to do or not.
It's certainly possible. We've looked into what that means, and as a pilot tool. We think it's fantastic and what that will mean ultimately. And we're working with it on another project at the moment.
Yep.
And so we can certainly take that away and see what that means for us. But I think it's a fantastic tool. I think this would blow it out of the water. Yeah. I don't know whether you'd use this as a benchmark every day of the week, but yeah.
Thank you, Cathy. Councillor Phil Lee Lou.
Thanks, Chair. I've got kind of two. One, he talked about activating, I guess, the ground up, but then I know in the report, you have to walk up, I'd imagine, five, flights of stairs to get to, I guess, the public realm and everything. What's the reasoning behind that? I mean, we noted that the PT trainers would love it, but, for some people, mere mortals, climbing that would be quite tremendous, and it seems more as a kind of a I wouldn't say a deterrent, but it would be difficult to going up.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think every year we could have the run up to the public space, and I think it'll be the Bueller. But that as it is, part of the aim of it is to promote active walking, and whether it's between level 3 and 4 to walk up or level 5 and 7, it is a really good tool to be able to get out and be outside and use active vertical circulation spaces. But that as it is, the circulation spaces internally through through the escalators and through the vertical transport and the internal stairs still work without the external stair. But the external stair also has terraces. So like a veranda, you have the opportunity of spending time breaking indoor and outdoor from the program that happens internally to the retail. So it works on many levels. So we think it all has value.
Okay. And the other one is this will be pretty much, what we'll call it, the representation of Melbourne, right? And, you know, Eureka Tower has always had that privilege in terms of, you know, being in the skyline and, you know, in the poster cards and everything. I just want to hear from you in terms of, you know, this building, the nexus behind the vision behind it, because this will be the highest, apart from maybe Queensbridge, if they ever come online, but I imagine this will be the highest. Mm-hmm. But it's just, you know, how does this tell the story about Melbourne? Because I was going to say, you know, Eureka Tower, you know, love it, because I can always say, you know, the red represents the blood, the gold represents what we fight for, and the blue and white represent the flag that, you know, we fought for. So what's the connection to Melbourne that tells it, if that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very important. Every building you do with this kind of profile actually says something about Melbourne and about Victoria and about how progressive it is, innovative it is, and also how relevant certain things have been in the past. And landscape to us and the idea of living amongst the gardens and living amongst the key boulevards of Melbourne in the past 150 years has been really key. And so that was a starting conversation that we had about how we drew the landscape up to the top of the building to create what was a future garden on top of it. So that public space on top represents how a snippet of how the Botanic Gardens become a key focal point for landscape sustainability and the environment for us moving forward as a city. Okay. Garden State. It used to be the Garden State. And unfortunately, I don't know whether we lost that, but we lost it somewhere. So we want to bring it back.
I think we've got a pub named after the Garden State. Just picking up on a question by Councillor Leilu about the outdoor staircase, which seems to have attracted a lot of attention. My own view is it's a great design feature of the podium, although when I read through the design commentary in the officer's report, it does make an observation about the activation of that staircase. I think the point is trying to be made that, you know, we just don't want it to be a staircase that runs along and there's entry points into the building. We want it to be a genuinely activated, broad public way of passage. So just interested in your thoughts around that.
Well, at the base of it, the public steps are more like, maybe it's a long bow, but the idea of the Spanish steps. You sit there, you meet at that destination point at the base. So it actually has a purpose at the base. But as we activate it, as we move up through the building, it's connected and activated by food and beverage, etc., off the retail that can be activating it with destinations. Not only do we have destinations that are activated through the program, but that idea of the layering of the arts and sculptural opportunities that go up through the building become a really good narrative as you move and progress up the building. So we think it's a walk in its own right that might have a narrative in its own right.
Thanks very much for that, Phil. If there aren't any other further questions, you can resume your seat.
Thank you.
And I will now call on Jock Gammon from Jungle Fire to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome to Town Hall, Jock.
Thanks for having me. Good evening, Lord Mayor and fellow councillors. To say that we're excited to be involved in this project is a massive understatement. It's going to be an iconic project on both a local and global scale. My name's Jock Gammon and I'm the founder and managing director of Jungle Fire, and together with my wife, we established Jungle Fire back in 2009. Since this time, we've grown to a team of 45 passionate jungle fires. We operate in New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia, and we actually have a long-term relationship with the City of Melbourne. We built your first green roof at the Venny in Kensington. We've been involved in writing the Growing Green Guide. And to Councillor Oakey's point, we're actually involved in writing the Greenhouse City Action Plan and attended the event last week for the Green Factor Talk. So this certainly would be a fantastic project to allow that to happen. We've installed over 200 projects around the world, around Australia, and we've introduced over 1 million plants and beneficial insects to our city. So we're not new to this game. We've been involved in the iconic One Central Park. We built the green walls on this project, and we've had the fortunate honour of looking after this project for the last 5 years. And it's on this project that we've learnt a huge amount of what to do and what not to do. And it's that experience that we're going to bring to this project. Imagine if all of our buildings looked like this. In our view, this is how our cities need to be built. This type of project is going to create cooler air temperature, it's going to increase biodiversity, it's going to clean the air, plus it's also going to provide a strong connection for the city and the people that live within it. And it's this connection with nature that we've lost in our cities and something that we desperately need to bring back. And I think this is a fantastic example of this type of project. We've been involved with Bueller and the design team that you see here tonight since the competition award. We brought our expertise into giving advice on planting topologies, planter box design, drainage, irrigation. We've also been involved with looking at light studies. And one of the key things for any project like this is how are we going to maintain it? And that's a key understanding that we have. Ropes access is the best method of maintaining these types of projects. And also how are we going to deal with and manage green waste. We're on a mission to jungle fire city. And I think with everyone in this room tonight, we have a fantastic opportunity of creating what are going to be truly regenerative types of buildings. And we look forward to working with you all to bring this project to life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jock. It's fair to say this project has attracted a lot of public attention, including from my mum, who's a keen gardener and has taken a great interest in what you're trying to do here, Jock. And so she has asked me on several occasions, do you have the right plantings that will grow at 365 metres, because climatic conditions at that height are very different to ground level in South Bank.
For sure. When we look at the planting types that we're going to be using, we can look to coastal environments where you do have strong winds, and we know that plants that have small leaf internodes, that have small leaf shapes, waxy leaves, there's a whole range of plant characteristics that we will look for as we go up the topology of the building. It's not going to be the same consistent planting throughout. We'll have lusher shade-tolerant species in the shadier areas down low, and looking to also incorporating biodiversity plants that are going to attract the beneficial insects to the city. So we'll be looking at that whole effect on planting topology as we move up the building. So we're confident that by doing an exhaustive study of all the different plants, both indigenous and exotic, we'll certainly be able to find plants that will be suitable for this project.
And in designing the green infrastructure for this building, have you made reference to the new green spine that's running through South Bank along South Bank Boulevards, the City of Melbourne project?
Just to be clear, our involvement in this project so far has been on a technical basis. We've worked with the International Landscape Architect Grant Associates in terms of doing the public realm. We've provided our technical expertise as to the best types of planter boxes or the best types of growing media to be using for the project. So I can't answer that one, unfortunately.
Any further questions? No. Oh, thank you. Councillor Lee Lu.
Thank you. And my question is pretty much the same as well in terms of the reasoning and the story, because, you know, this is what we're going to be looking at when everyone sees it. So it's just greening to the building. Like, you know, I know you talked about, you know, you want to bring back, you know, turning this, you know, I guess, concrete to green and everything. But just your vision and the kind of the strategy behind, because, I you know, just knowing, just want to hear a bit more about it and the vision that you came up with, the idea and everything.
Look, again, the concept and the idea was through Cox and UN Studio. We've been brought in from a technical point of view, but from our point of view, this, again, connection with nature is something that we desperately need in our cities. And to give the residents within the building that outlook of the natural greenery, they can't actually get access to it. So that will be part of the whole body corporate and management structure. And I think when the question was raised about the longevity and viability of this project, Bueller and the team have a very good understanding of the maintenance requirements that are going to be needed on such a project. And I think once you get that sorted out and it's integrated from the very early inception, this is how these projects are a success. We've learned a lot from One Central Park. BMUs break down all the time. They're not the best way of maintaining a project. And we've developed strategies where our ropes team can be really strategic to be able to get down, maintain garden beds effectively, move the green waste out, and keep the building looking its best throughout the year. Plus a very modular design with planter boxes and other things like that to give that flexibility.
Okay.
All right, if there aren't any further questions, Jock, you can resume your seat. Thank you very much for that presentation this evening. There should now be a recommendation appearing up on the screen, and as Chair of Planning, I am happy to move a motion supporting that recommendation and looking for a councillor to second it. Thank you, Councillor Leppert. We sometimes hear people in this city say, Melbourne has never seen anything like it. And that is often said with a little bit of exaggeration. But I actually think tonight we can actually say Melbourne has never seen anything like what we are currently considering. Certainly in the 170 years that this council has been sitting, we have never seen a building as tall as this one come before us for consideration. In fact, there's never been a tower this tall considered in Australia or built in Australia, or indeed I think it will be the tallest in the southern hemisphere. We are talking about 265,000 square metres of building and floor space here. That is quite mind-boggling to anybody who follows buildings in this country. But look, when I say Melbourne has never seen anything like it, it's not just the height, it's not just the size, it's to do with the degree of thought and so many of the design aspects and other features of this proposal. I make no secret of my support for the use of design competitions in Melbourne, particularly on big projects, particularly on landmark sites, particularly in places where we know it's going to have a big impact on the city. And so I was absolutely delighted to see the design competition which was held for this project. I think it's fair to say there was probably a touch of Hollywood about that design competition. Certainly it generated a lot of excitement around town. Certainly there were some aspects of it which may not have tied directly into the built form controls that exist in that part of the city. But I've got to say that the final result that came out and the winning team involving UN Studios and Cox Architecture, it was nothing short of absolutely stunning. So, and you've produced a tall tower proposal with those twisting towers, the green infrastructure that goes with it, tying into that green spine around along South Bank Boulevard. It will be an absolutely amazing addition to South Bank, in my view. Just on a policy note, I will note that the built form controls in that part of the city, across Melbourne actually, or Central City, require a plot ratio of 18 to, or built form ratio of 18 to 1. The project we have before us tonight is 38 to 1. So that's 20 to 1 above the 18 to 1 ratio. Of course, we do have a floor area uplift mechanism that operates in the Central City and South Bank, and in the case of this particular project, it required a floor area uplift value of about $138 million to be produced. And I note that on this particular project, through it including 27,000 square metres of office, you are able to develop to produce $150 million worth of floor area uplift value, which then makes this project compliant with the planning controls for the city. Now, I don't actually want to take anything away from this project in terms of design. I think the inclusion of office is an additional bonus feature that'll only add to the project. But I do, as a City of Melbourne councillor, reflect on all the other good that could be done for the city, for South Bank, from something like $138 million in required contribution in public value from a project like this. So that's more a policy point that I make directed at Spring Street rather than our proponents here tonight. But I do want to note it, given C270 is something which is currently under review.
Having said that, I should say beyond the 27,000 odd square metres of office space for Melbourne, this project does add a lot of other community benefits as well. As Tony Penner pointed out, there is the very significant investment in new infrastructure along South Bank and City Road. There's the 100 Place Childcare Centre. There's the Community and Entertainment Conference Centre, which will be terrific. There's the offering up of not-for-profit space as well. So there's been a really thoughtful consideration has gone in here around what are the community benefits that a project like this can deliver. It's very much noted by us as councillors, and we do thank you for that. I also have concerns about that sort of network of laneways that sit to the north of the BMW site in City Road. So you've got Waterfall Lane that runs along there. Tony Penner told us about, you know, you take your life in your hands when you drive along there. I do think the additional traffic will add some pressure to that intersection, notwithstanding the fact that the traffic modelling shows us it should be sufficient. The point I'm trying to make here is that I think going forward, the City of Melbourne does need to look at that Waterfall Lane and the easement and private laneways that exist between Freshwater Place, this site here, up to Power Street and down to South Bank Boulevard, because I do think we need to do that better. And I look for inspiration here to what's happened on the other side of South Bank Boulevard, where Mervac have invested significantly in upgrading the laneways between their Riverside Quay development, and something like a treatment like that through that network of laneways, easement and private laneways, I think would go a long, long way to improving South Bank. In conclusion, can I very much thank the officers. I know it has been a long journey to get here tonight. Jane, thank you for taking us through those series of conditions which you have developed. I think they'll significantly improve the project. And finally, I'd also like to acknowledge Bueller and the team at Bueller. They are relative newcomers to Melbourne. I do think they are adding very significantly to built form in this city, helping us build a fantastic city. And this is the biggest and best thing we've seen from them yet. So well done. I have no hesitation in supporting the recommendations on the screen. Councillor Lippitt.
Thank you, Chair. I have no hesitation either. This is a spectacular application, and if and when built, it's going to instantly change the presentation of South Bank. And whilst the towers themselves are incredibly striking addition to Melbourne's skyline, if and when built, I think the thought that's gone into the ground plane and the multi-storey activation with the public access, not just to the ground floor, but further up, the fragmented podium, if you like, of the building is brilliantly well thought through. As many people might know, I was highly critical of aspects of the design process, and I'm glad that we're not recognising the design competition as a public benefit, not that we need to, because the public benefits are overwhelming. Far more have been provided than were required in the FAU, and I'm delighted that they're all being locked in by way of Section 173 agreement. But with that design competition behind us, I still thought that the winner, it had to be Cox, this is absolutely spectacular. Sure enough, it was. And with that design competition behind us, I note that it does comply in every way with Jamie's favourite control, mine too, Jamie. And it's demonstration that you can get quite spectacular outcomes in this part of the city. Yes, it is a large site, so I will concede that again. And the limitation isn't the control or the rule in the Melbourne planning scheme. It's the limit placed on height by CASA. And I look forward to seeing the outcome of that process as well. I really do hope that the building can be built, because this is an example of something that has a lot of care and thought put into the design process, not just a spectacular tower, but further down at the ground level, and all of the additions that have been proposed to be provided, public benefits inside and outside the building, the cash contributions outside the building as well. We should acknowledge that they are significant. So I congratulate the applicant, and I strongly support the motion before us.
Thank you, Councillor Lippitt. Councillor Leilu.
Thank you, Chair. And look, I don't usually ask a lot of questions in the planning. I usually just do the reading and then just usually agree with it. But, you know, it's not every day you get to ask questions about what is going to be the iconic, you know, the iconic vision of Melbourne, to put it bluntly. I note that, you know, while it is outside of the Melbourne Art Precinct, but due to the fact that there is a lot of synergy with the Art Culture Lab, I think that's really amazing, because South Bank, as we all know, is the art precinct, and how we actually connect with that, I think it's very important, because ultimately that's what a lot of people go to there for. I apologise if I took some of the question I have, but you know, it's for me, it's the iconic, you know, what's the story it's trying to tell for Melbourne, because this is what is going to be around the world. And, you know, for me, when somebody's going to ask me, you know, what is this all about? You know, at least with the Eureka Tower, I know exactly the story I need to tell. 108, I wasn't too sure. But this, I kind of get it, because, you know, when I look across South Bank, it's all grey, it's all concrete. But yet, if you are able to see something coming out from the ground, the greenery, then I think that's, you know, that's a story to tell. And again, you know, it's just the amount of gardens that we have in the, you know, Governor La Trobe, and putting all the places of the greenery in place. But if instead of going sideways, we're going upwards, I think that's a, you know, very bold vision. So I'm very supportive of this as well. But I again note, you know, this, you're literally taking, you know, Melbourne in your hands, because this is essentially what we're going to be. You know, this is what people are going to see around the world. I mean, no Melbourne, and you know, and that's a very, very big responsibility to have. So, all the best to you guys.
Thank you, Councillor Leilu. Councillor Oak.
Thank you, Chair. Everyone's sick of me talking about how long I've been here, but about 10 or 12 years ago, when these horrible big towers would come to the planning committee for decision, there was limited scope that we had within the planning scheme to have any impact on these horrors, to be honest, that have, you know, built up in the city. And we'd, you know, there was very little contributing to residents, very little contributing to the city. In fact, they've created these crazy wind tunnels, limited green open space, or even, you know, access to any amenities. So I'm surprised that I'm wholeheartedly putting my hand up to support, you know, such a high development that has come towards us tonight. I mean, obviously, we're not the responsible authority, but, you know, giving my support to the recommendation on the screen, I'm surprised, given the height and the density and the issues that usually come with that, that we are grappled with having to kind of accept because of the rules that we have to play with. But so I'm very pleased that, you know, as colleagues have spoken about, the uplift that is being provided as a result of controls that we do have to work with, not perfect entirely, and certainly agree with Councillor Rees in the dubious social contribution of commercial space, but I can understand why it is there at the moment and why it was in... why it's in there. So I understand it, but it is maybe slightly dubious, but I agree that there are significant other contributions that are being made through the development in front of us. So I thank the applicants for that. And with respect to the green and the story, I know Councillor Leilu has been asking today and tonight about what is the story of Melbourne that this building is contributing to, and if the story of Melbourne isn't about greening, or if we're not behind the story of Melbourne being a green place, then I'm not sure, you know, what story we should be behind, because the City of Melbourne certainly for many years have been talking about the idea of the city within a forest, and we're never going to get to that, the renders that we use to talk about a city within a forest, because to be honest, they are mostly renders, because we have very limited greening in the private realm at the moment, that, you know, if 70% of our land is private, we have very little, you know, limited opportunity as a council to make sure that we do have green buildings. And GOCAP, or Green Our City Action Plan, is all about this building. And I really, you know, appreciate the contribution that Jungle Fire has made to other buildings within the municipality, but also being part of our GOCAP process and the Green Factor tool that I'm very excited about, and hope that more developers get involved in the prototyping and then even voluntarily getting involved is exciting. So I'm certainly interested in making sure that that greenery on that building is maintained, and certainly seems like you've got the right advice as part of the project, and hopefully, you know, our research community can also get involved in understanding which plants do survive at such heights and maintain for a long time. So, yeah, I support this, not just for the greenery, but also because of all of the other parts of the development, and understand that it complies certainly with the conditions attached more so. So, yeah, I support the recommendation.
Thank you, Councillor. Councillor Francis Gilley.
Hi, thank you. I also think it's an extraordinary building, and I think... I think, Jock, you know, you and your partner's work's inspiring. That you make, that you manage to green buildings and keep them green, you know, is something we need to learn, obviously, to make our cities live and breathe. And really good luck with this, because I think it's actually, I do think it is essential if the building is to actually be iconic. I think two things you said today actually have really, Councillor Louis, have really made me think that I don't like it. I love the building. I just don't like that and I think you're right, it may define Melbourne. It's iconic, but it's a building that you could find anywhere in the world. It could be in Singapore, it could be in Hong Kong, it could be anywhere. And the green strip that flows down from a road that's green, that we've just made green, that isn't green yet because we've only just made it, may or may not say something. I think that we have very little responsibility actually for holding what Melbourne is in terms of design and building, because actually it's held by the state. I've only been in this country 20 years. I've always been in Melbourne. I think its personality and why it's one of the most livable cities in the world is I'm not sure that we will hold on. I don't know what it will become. I think it will be defined by buildings and big buildings with lots of people in them. And Tony, I think 270 car spaces in a little laneway is going to be a struggle too. But, you know, I'm not sure what we're saying yes to. And I want to say this is a beautiful building and it does define it. But I also just want to put on record, I don't know what we're creating. I don't think it's anyone in particular, but we're going down a route. And I think if we want to think about cities that hold centres where people connect and build things that are seen as the most livable places in the world, I'm not sure that really big buildings with lots of people in them are going to define us. And I don't think they'll ever make us exceptional, although the building may be iconic. So I've got no answer. There's nothing wrong with it. I think it's an amazing building. But I don't like it. And I think partly one of the things is because of it's the highest. There was something about that when here we go, higher. And I'm just thinking, okay, how much higher are we going to go? You know, and is there a point where you don't actually see what's on the street because there's so much height around you, so much shade, that you've forgotten that the pavement and the trees that you're around? Anyway, I don't know. I'm grateful for the quality work that you've done, and I will support it today, but I just wanted to note my concern.
Thank you, Councillor Francis Gilley. Councillor Pinder.
Thank you, Chair. Just very quickly, I love it. The innovation, the creativity, sustainability, obviously. I'm a local down that part, and it's fantastic. I'd love you to consider perhaps a collaboration with the Australian Ballet School for that not-for-profit space. There's some great things coming out of that school just around the corner, and if something could be done with them, would be fantastic. That's my contribution.
First bit in there for that NFP office space. Lord Mayor.
Good. Well, I support this application. I think opportunities for developments of this size and ambition are very rare within our city. I note the comments and concerns from Councillor Francis Gilley. As somebody that lives on a level 30, the different perspectives and engagement with the city, it is different, but it's still good. And I imagine that as those levels go further up, there's still the same sense of engagement and perspective, and that's what we would hope for. I think the green rippling twist, which to me is very M.C. Escher-like, is both confounding and astounding. Parts of what I love about M.C. Escher is what we see, and I think it will become a fascinating part to our city. I do note that in that part that we call South Bank, I think we can probably start considering it to be called Cloud Bank, given how many buildings are striving consistently to be the tallest and ever so closer to those clouds. And perhaps that is what will become distinctive about that part of the city. But there is no doubt that one of our challenges in South Bank at the moment is that access to green open space per square metre per person. And so that ambition about bringing green along and up the building is something that I think will be very welcomed in that part of the city. I commend Beulah for responding so well to community, to local conditions, to officers' comments, and obviously working with a team, including Jock and Phil and Jamie, who have presented this evening, and I'm sure many more who have been involved in this very ambitious project. Our officers are recommending a number of conditions to the project, quite a number. I believe that they've been discussed and agreed with by Beulah and the team, and I can see some nods over there. And I think that those conditions do improve. Jamie's shaking his head and nodding at the same time. A few twists, I'm sure, but I think that we're agreed that the conditions really are aimed at improving the outcomes for South Bank and the city whilst retaining the ambition of the project. And that's why we have these interactions. That's why these projects come through council, is for us to be able to make those contributions, given that ultimately we don't sign off finally on the project. I just wanted to pick up on one of them, which was the inclusion of the pedestrian thoroughfare through the site between, or takes us through to Freshwater Place and then onto Queensbridge Square. I think that those sorts of ways of providing accessibility through what could otherwise be viewed as fortresses in the sky are really important, and they do add considerably, not just to egress around the area, but really to that sense of vibrancy and human activity. So I particularly wanted to note that as one of the recommendations. I'm really happy to support this project with the conditions put by our team. Thanks to our team for their thoroughness and their thoughtfulness and the way in which they have worked with Beulah. I know it's been this complex because one of my first meetings was actually understanding the outcomes of that amazing design project, design competition, and almost 2 years later we're still talking about it, but it feels like we're going through this gate based on the comments we've received so far. So well done to everyone. I do hope that the Minister considers the application with our recommendations and is supportive, and I'm happy to be in favour of this evening.
Thank you very much, Lord Mayor. Are there any other speakers for or against the motion? In that case, I move the motion, and all those councillors in favour, please raise your hand. I'm declaring that carried unanimously. Well, all right, the next agenda item is 6.2, Draft Affordable Housing Strategy. Did councillors want a presentation on this item? I'm taking that as a no, and so I'll just pause for a moment while people leave the room. Thank you very much for your attendance this evening. I now call on Michael Lennon from Housing Choices Australia, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome to Town Hall, Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Lord Mayor, thank you, members of council, for the opportunity to speak to this item this evening. My organisation, Housing Choices, is one of a number of not-for-profit community housing providers in Victoria. We are headquartered here and elsewhere in Australia. We exist solely for the purpose of providing good, safe homes to people who are vulnerable or who are in low incomes. Housing Choices was formed from a merger of three smaller housing associations, all of them sponsored by the City of Melbourne at some point in the past. These are Melbourne Affordable Housing, the Ecumenical Housing Trust, and the Inner City Housing Trust. And while we've achieved a certain amount, we've all watched with increasing alarm and dismay as affordable housing supply within the city and across the state has gone backwards to an astonishing degree. So we've all watched as the private property and investment sectors were provided with little or no incentive to participate in the delivery of affordable housing. And we've watched as the public housing system has struggled and declined bit by bit to a point where we now have the lowest expenditure of any state or territory in Australia. We've also watched as the needs of low-income residents and vulnerable residents in the city were lost along the way in amongst a great frenzy of property speculation. So, Mr. Chairman, Lewis Mumford, the American urban theorist, said the test of any city is the life it makes possible for its citizens. On that definition, we are failing a significant number of people. Over the last decade, community housing provider organisations like ours and our colleagues have increasingly stepped in to fill the ever-widening gap in the housing market. And we have done our best and we have done much, but there is a great amount to do. But without serious and proactive intervention from all levels of government, without serious commitment from everyone, Melbourne will continue to be on track to becoming the least affordable housing city in this country. So organisations like ours have worked with the city over many years. The Drill Hole, Epsworth House, Guildford Lane are amongst the projects that we have done. Ideas, Mr. Chairman, need to find their time. So the policy from the council hopefully follows the MAC report on to the Minister of Planning, the recent publications from the Urban Development Institute, amongst others. We may well be on the cusp of a significant change. Even if everything in your plan goes to plan, the city will still be around 18,000 homes short in less than 20 years' time. We'll be making a formal submission in response to this strategy, but Mr. Chair, Council Members, Lord Mayor, I want to commend everyone in the city for their leadership which has been sadly lacking in many other places, but which is outstanding and which is demonstrably needed for this city. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michael, and thank you for everything you do for our city. It is noted and appreciated. I now call on Roberta Buchanan, who's also from Housing Choices Australia, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome, Roberta.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Lord Mayor, councillors, officers and the public. Whilst I am from Housing Choices Australia, I'm also the community housing sector's nominated chair for our peak body, the Community Housing Industry Association of Victoria. So I'm pleased to speak in support of Council's plans to tackle the dire shortage of affordable housing in our city. We all know a secure and affordable home is fundamental to a quality of life, to dignity, to access to opportunities. Despite this, the availability of social and affordable housing has failed to meet the rapidly increasing need, and it's vital that all levels of government step up to assist where they can. That the City of Melbourne plans to take a leadership role in this space, including advocating to make affordable housing and new developments mandatory is great news for those priced out of the private housing market. So on behalf of the community housing industry of Victoria, I would like to commend the committee for its efforts in developing the affordable housing strategy and encourage council's adoption. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Roberta. I now call on Tony Penner from the South Bank Residents Association to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome back to the lectern, Tony.
Thank you. In the limited time that we had to review the agenda for today's meeting, we have put together a submission for this important agenda item, albeit short. But in principle, South Bank Residents Association is supportive of an affordable housing strategy. We acknowledge the current living constraints faced by many members of our community, yet and or can be productive and willing members of society.
We believe in an inclusive and diverse society, therefore we are committed to supporting the City of Melbourne with developing their strategy. We are aware of the City's plan for affordable housing in the Boyd development within the South Bank, and we support this plan. We ask that South Bank Residents Association is not overlooked with the consultation phase of this strategy, as we are keen to be involved. Short and sweet.
Thank you very much, Tony. All right, there should now be a recommendation is appearing on the screen. I should move a motion to support that, and I'm looking for a councillor to second. Thank you very much, Councillor Pinder. Can I begin by thanking the officers for the tremendous amount of high-quality work that has gone into developing this affordable housing strategy? Kate Dundas, Emma Appleton and the team, this is an outstanding bit of public policy work. This is real thought leadership for our city and frankly, for our nation. Well done. The report spells out, I think, very clearly the challenge that Melbourne faces. It identifies that we already, as of today, have a shortfall of 5,500 affordable rental homes in this city for people on low and moderate incomes. Even more alarmingly, that is expected to increase significantly to around 27,000 by 2036. So what is very, very inescapably clear is that business as usual is not going to cut it for Melbourne if we want to see ourselves as a truly fair, equitable and livable city. And the truth is there is an equity dimension to what we're discussing here tonight. There is indeed a moral dimension as well, I would argue. We like to say that we're a city for people, and if we say that, we've got to be a city for all people. We like to say that we're the world's most livable city, but you can't be the world's most livable city if people can't afford to live here. So I actually think that this affordable housing strategy is one of the most important bits of work that the city has done, certainly in my term as a councillor. There's four major priorities that are identified in the strategy. The first of those goes to advocacy for mandatory inclusionary zoning for people who have been on council for a long time or who know this place well. They'll know that this has been a contested area of policy, very contested. And so the fact that the city is now making the move to embracing inclusionary zoning is a brave and right step. Truth is, of course, most cities like Melbourne around Australia and around the world have already embraced something like inclusionary zoning, and the evidence is there that it does deliver, and so it is very much time for Melbourne to do the same. Second major priority identified is the development of affordable rental housing on City of Melbourne land, and I know there's a lot of work going on in that area, and I think there'll be more to say going forward there. The City of Melbourne's also committing to strengthening our internal affordable housing processes, something which I think will be welcomed by the sector and I think can make a difference. And then fourthly, we've agreed to advocate and partner with other councils, state and federal government, for further affordable housing interventions. I mean, there's no silver bullet to solving affordable housing. The truth is it's something that the City of Melbourne can't do alone. We need to collaborate and work with other tiers of government, state and federal, to turn things around. I think there's a lot of goodwill there. We now just need to push ahead and do some of these things, and I really, truly think that that is going to happen. Can I conclude by just saying that this is a strategy? It is now being put out for consultation. This is just one step in a very important conversation for our city. It's not the final word, so we are genuinely looking to housing providers, to the social services sector, to the development community to give us feedback, because we want to get this right, we must get this right, and we will get it right. Councillor Pinder.
Thanks, Chair. Look, this is always a difficult one for me because it's closer to home than most know or think. But there is a housing crisis, as we know. It's facing us all as Australians. But is it about getting into the market or actually staying off the streets? And it is obviously far more systemic than that. I mean, just a little yarn. 3, 4, 5 weeks ago, my husband offered someone on the street at DFO a safe, clean place to live for $150 a week. And he said, no, thank you, mate. So close to a railway station and everything, and my husband was serious. So we have some systemic problems in terms of attitudes as well and illnesses. But the affordable housing subject, I guess, I just want to say to Emma, thank you for taking me along this path for several months now. You've put a lot of time and effort into making me understand it and I feel better for it. But the thing is, the curve for need and the curve for supply. I mean, that's the tragedy here. You know, it's that gap is going to be huge for a long, long time. And while we must ensure that local governments do not take over that, which is essentially federal or state remit, you know, providing 23,200 affordable homes, which is what the SGS economics people have predicted by 2036, that is an uphill battle. And I think it's going to challenge each and every one of us. And in fact, it's a lot closer to home than most of us think, because for each and every one of us, our families will be affected at some stage in their lives. So what's the proposition? Do we leave the market to its own devices? And clearly we can't. That's been identified. And it's great to see as our priorities. One of our priorities being that the City of Melbourne will actually put up land. And I think, you know, putting our money where our mouth is very important to all stakeholders within the sector. And it will allow the some supply to be achieved at a faster rate. And God only knows we need that. Strengthening the city's processes and advocating and partnering for affordable housing, all priorities that will be well received. So well thought through, good actions. My only hope is that this the inclusionary zoning is not seen as a tax by developers. You know, it's kind of like we don't want to kill the golden goose either. We've got to be careful there. So we've got to really explore the feedback and see what people are saying. We know that the market's not very strong right now, housing is, apartments are not selling right now. People are opting for either greenfield developments or established homes. So therein lies a bit of a problem as well. But there are two questions that I think need to be posed. What is the definition of affordable housing? Is it rental or is it purchasing? And I have in my mind it is as rental. So I just hope that is what eventuates with all of this. The second question is who ends up paying for it? And that's a major question that I believe is primarily the jurisdiction of the state government, but we all have a share of it. It's a responsibility that we all share. So it's very important that we understand that, we proceed with that intent in mind. We also need to think about a broad-based approach to enable broad-based funding and look at the various models. Michael, you mentioned that Melbourne will probably be the worst city. I think Sydney is facing the same crippling situation as we are, and there's several reports that have been done in the last couple of years on the Sydney market, so I'd send you something on that as well. But, you know, 5 to 10% of stock in every project being allocated to affordable housing, that worries me. Some will just not be suitable, and policy must allow for private developers, I think, to be able to trade and collaborate with people like yourselves. And I think your point, you know, bringing together all the stakeholders, I think is a very important one. And I do hope that you play a very big role in all of this in time to come. Support the recommendations wholeheartedly, obviously, and look forward to its evolution.
Thank you very much, Councillor Pinder. Are there any other speakers for or against? Councillor Leilu.
Thank you, Chair. And look, I note that one of the things that I always, you know, for me, it's about the cost of living. And this is probably one of the levers which way. Melbourne's not too bad. I mean, if you look at one of the rankings that I have, we are 87 in the world. But in terms of in Australia, we're actually 10th, Sydney being the highest. So, you know, we have over a period of time in terms of previous councils and councillors and government have actually done pretty well. I still remember, you know, as someone who lives in an apartment, I'd always, you know, and people always complain to me about how come their apartment never increase in value, and my mentor and predecessor would always, who was the chair of planning, would always say, you know, didn't want to end up like Sydney where it's just scarce. And I think, you know, there will only be certain points to going that, but going through the affordable housing strategy, I think it's a must because, you know, having a look around the world, you know, looking at Singapore. Where, you know, the discussion now around the 99-year lease, which is owned by the government, is now creeping up. If you look at Hong Kong, you know, that is probably the worst place. You will not be able to buy anything other than a shoebox. So for us to get this right, I think it's quite important because, you know, we are a growing city. We will be the biggest city in Australia. You know, and you know, with the growth that's happening, I think we will be one of the most internationally renowned. I also want to just note and highlight page 18 of the report because it sets out the role of government, and I just want to just re-emphasise, you know, the City of Melbourne's role. We have a very minor role, but we are trying to do a lot more. You know, if you look at Australian government and the Victorian government, the bulk of it lies with them, and it's not something that I want City of Melbourne to be burdened with because it's not one of the things that we've got a lot of things to do, but we have so little power and also resource to go and tackle something like this, especially for a capital city. So, you know, in terms of the expectation, I think, you know, we are doing the best we can and we want to try and, you know, to ensure we want to bring everyone along with us. But ultimately, it's a market-driven, you know, like right now, even though interest rate is absolutely low, but if you go to an auction any other day, you know, the prices just skyrocket like crazy because it's that's the market. So, you know, there's a lot of levers and things that we cannot control, but the expectation should not be on that, you know, City of Melbourne can solve everything because that's something that we can't do. But what we can do is make an example, lead by example, and hopefully we can get one or two to come with us and share that vision.
Thank you, Councillor Leilu. Are there any other speakers for or against? Councillor Leppett.
Thank you, Chair. I support this as well, noting that it's a draft and I'm really looking forward to the consultation process and what comes back to us from the other side. But I agree with those comments. Even if all of the actions that we're discussing and proposing in this strategy come to life and can be acted on, we're still tinkering at the edges. We're not rewriting market economics here. We are the council that's governing the very centre of the economic heart of the state. It's where land values are the highest. It's where all sorts of agglomeration effects are going to dictate that land values are more likely than not to keep increasing. And there's a really big question as to how efficient it is to set new controls in planning rules, to set new incentives for the development of new housing, to provide other sorts of incentives or other sorts of disincentives to work against those forces. I'm very much in favour of doing that, but I think the best way to do that is fairly, transparently, and as accountably as possible, as broadly as possible. One of the reasons I think why a previous push for inclusionary zoning in this place did not succeed is that in lieu of a national housing strategy, and we still don't have one, and in lieu of a state political consensus, it was pretty clear that a City of Melbourne go-it-alone strategy, even if we had the consensus for it, which I had hoped we would but we didn't, was going to be fought tooth and nail by the property industry for all the obvious reasons, and that's completely understandable. The advocacy position we're taking in this document, and I hope the advocacy position that the Ministerial Advisory Committee is recommending to the state government, is for a system that takes account of our neighbours in other states, takes account of the market and the planning system across the state of Victoria, and seeks to apply and start at a pretty low base an inclusionary zoning regime that is very fair, very transparent, very accountable for all players, so that there's absolute certainty for everyone. But that is just one of the elements of what is a draft strategy, and it may not be where we land, and as councillors have said, we don't dictate what the planning state provisions are going to be, and we can advocate for something, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to get it. Even if we do get an inclusionary zoning regime in place, even if we do have slightly stronger controls for our urban renewal areas, that's still only starting to tackle some of the problem. As my colleagues have said, we are in the middle of a housing crisis, and this is just one element. I really am looking to the state for the strongest possible leadership coming out of the Ministerial Advisory Committee's recommendations and an announcement as soon as possible in the coming weeks as to what the state of Victoria is going to do at the state level. Yes, we know we need leadership at the national level. As I said, we still have no national housing strategy, and that is an absolute disgrace. We have no replacement schemes for the old financing schemes like NRAS and the like, but we're not going to get them anytime soon. At least at the state and the local level, if we can do what we haven't managed to do for quite some time, and that is truly coordinate with a statewide housing strategy with councils on board and the property industry on board as well, I think we can actually make some changes. So I read with great interest every word of the opinion piece of the UDIA and the Herald Sun over the weekend. There was tentative support for the ideas that came through, and that was wonderful to see. If other elements of the property industry don't like what they see in this draft strategy, that's fine too. Tell us what you would like. We have to work together, or this housing crisis is not going to be solved. I hope at least we can all agree, no matter what side of the financing equation that we're on, that we do have a crisis, that we do need to figure out how to make sure that people have a place to live. And if we can at least agree on that baseline, please use this consultation process to tell us what you think the solutions are. Don't only tell us what you think why these solutions might not work for you, and I'm sure we'll still get a few of those, and that's okay. Thank you. I'm really looking forward to what comes out at the end of this process, because it is one of the most important things we're going to do.
Thank you very much, Councillor Leppard. Are there any other speakers? Councillor Francis Gilley.
Hi. Emma and Kate, well done. Please say thank you to the team. Extraordinary piece of work and broader, all those involved. My first job here was running the Brotherhood of St Lawrence for 5 years, and it was started by Gerald Tucker 80 years ago because he chained himself to the wall of a building trying to safeguard a woman's rights to a home. And so, you know, it's been a big issue in this country. It started lots of organisations, and we really had a response to it well when the state took on building public housing. And I think, you know, something changed, but we stopped. And we stopped, and it's gone backwards. And not only has it gone backwards, we've replaced it with nothing. So I think the interesting thing here is we're advocating for change, but we're recognising that we can only, in the three recommendations here, there are two that we can act on that are really not going to change the numbers. Their leadership, and we should absolutely do them, but the advocacy is for the state government to say, yes, we'll change the mandatory inclusionary zoning to ensure that we get at least part of the problem filled. But I would say, you know, actually, to the state government, you have not acted for some time, and you've been in a position that you could. This is an opportunity to do it with others and not to do it straight out of the public purse. But you also have to bring the public purse to this. This is a problem that is growing. We have not been in this space. We saw the same thing with public transport, and now we're having to do it quickly, and so you can't get around the city because we're having to do it all at the last minute. We actually have to have a program that delivers this over the next 10 years, and that takes strategy, and well done for building some. It takes more strategy than this because they've got to take responsibility for building their own, and it needs to be done over the next 10 years. And that's my concern, is that we won't see that.
Sorry. Thank you very much, Councillor Francis Gilley. Councillor Oak.
Thank you, Chair, and apologies, we were being a bit distracted just our colleague, Councillor Watts, had left, and this is an issue that she wanted to speak on as well, but she's all okay. So absolutely, as my colleagues have said, I think that this is, a great piece of work. The previous piece of work was really fabulous, so we didn't quite get to, but this is really built on that, the strength of policy work that we have in the City of Melbourne, and I know a lot of people who were involved in the one that preceded this are still working on this one as well as a new team thinking about really how do we, take something that we have all agree we don't have all hands on all levers and do what we can and what we can as a capital city, around the advocacy, the action that we can actually commit, but also to influence. And so having a document that really spells it out and really gives some options for discussion, I think is really excellent. And so thank you for all of the work there. And I too look forward to genuine consultation and not just like last time just focusing on one thing that let's lobby the council to make sure we don't have the mandatory inclusion rezoning and let's make sure that we lower the percentage of of affordable beds within property that we commission ourselves as well. Let's hear what people have to say and let's hope that it only but strengthens what's before us, and obviously strengthening also comes from those that we need to work with and making sure that we're really clear how we can work together, and hopefully other levels of government come to the party sooner rather than later. It would be great. Again, it would be good to not only just be tinkering on the edges, as you say, but actually do it delivering what we need, because the last item on the agenda, we spoke about these great, fabulous towers, but, there wasn't, a very much affordable housing in that said development, were there, and, the state government really need to put proper targets in the planning control so that in the future when we do praise such beautiful buildings, we're praising them because there also is a level of affordability as well.
Thank you, Councillor Oak. Any other speakers for or against? Lord Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor Rees. Well, I think this is momentous, and I thank our team, and I also thank the speakers who have come tonight, Michael, Roberta and Tony. I'm surprised we didn't have thousands of people coming, given how important this piece of work is, but I hope that they're saving themselves up for massive engagement in terms of feedback. Thank you. I reiterate the sentiment of everybody here tonight. Housing is essential and we have neglected it over decades, and we have. Every single person that can vote in this country over that time have allowed our levels of government, all of us, to prioritise roads, rail, bridges over housing. And yet we know from all of the studies that housing has definitely been economic, social, community benefits in leveraged and exponential ways, and yet somehow we allowed it to fall off the agenda nationally at a state level and a local level. I think that in addition to us all taking responsibility, we recognise that we all have a role to play in this. And whilst I acknowledge some of the comments tonight about this being incremental and we are not the main level of government for this, I actually disagree with comments about the fact that we can't play a major role in this. We can. Just by changing our own thinking and policy response to this, we are creating ripples that can have major impacts in both the thinking and the action of other levels of government and the way in which we work together and change attitudes and actions in the community and beyond. And so that is why I'm so excited about this, even if only part of this policy is about things that we can do ourselves. We know we have to act at scale and pace, and so every single bit of momentum that we can add to that, I think, is not just persuasive, but a level of leadership that is needed. We know that this policy represents step change, as I said, and not just in policy. I mean, sometimes people think of policy as a whole piece of work that then gets put on a shelf. It's not about that. This policy is about action and it's about outcomes, and that's why it's exciting for us to be considering this draft policy in the state that it's in. It sets targets, it identifies initiatives and advocacy, and it commits us to action. Oh, I'm so excited that we're at this stage. We've got something that's thoughtful, considered, that really is setting the agenda and the pace together with so many partners that we have on this issue across community. I highly commend it. I am looking forward to the feedback, and I look forward to the next stage after that, and I hope that we see thousands of people come to participate in that debate. So congratulations to everyone. Thank you, and I'm very much in support of this motion this evening.
Thank you very much, Lord Mayor. I will now put the motion to a vote. All those in favour, please raise your hand. I declare that carried unanimously. I now call on Councillor Leppett to assume the role of Chair of the meeting in relation to the Heritage Portfolio. Over to you, Rohan.
Thanks, Councillor Rees. There's one report from management for consideration under this part of the planning portfolio, which is the Heritage section, and that is Agenda Item 6.3, Planning Scheme Amendment C365, Chart House Heritage. I'm shocked that this isn't what everyone's here to see. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? No. Tristan, welcome. On behalf of Melbourne Heritage Action, would you like to make a presentation to us? You have up to 3 minutes. Thank you.
Thanks, Lord Mayor and councillors. Just also want to quickly thank Chris for his questions before about the Palace Theatre, and also for your statements about housing affordability, which I feel kind of weird talking about this after that. Slightly lower scale, but this is an important issue. I'd just like to say that we urge you to agree with the management that the panel's decision can't be supported, given how vague it was and how it didn't really match with the evidence given. But we do disagree with the recommendation here to adopt the panel's decision regardless of your issues with it. We believe the panel's decision-making was flawed, given it gives far too much weight to how much this particular building has been altered on a cosmetic level, or I guess like an architecturally purist kind of sense of what heritage is. And it loses sight of the bigger picture that this building's form and details still clearly contribute to the wider heritage precinct, which we're talking about, which it sits right in the middle of. It's clearly the sort of interwar building that makes this precinct unique, even if it is altered. The panel states that it has been significantly altered, but did not provide any evidence on this point, and in fact only used evidence by Council's heritage advisor, which was actually meant to prove the building was contributory rather than non-contributory. That's a bit odd. The panel did not look at the context of the precinct either when it made its decision, where a number of contributory buildings are far more altered than Chart House is, such as a number of warehouses you can see there on Hardware Lane and various other buildings in the precinct. Chart House indeed actually maintains its original 1941 shop fronts and even painted signage for John Donne, who was a pretty big developer of the industry of the area then, and a number of references to him are throughout the precinct. And it's got a clear historic and visual connection, therefore, at the ground level and human scale to the precinct's history. Indeed, it's pretty rare to find an intact shop front anywhere in the entire CBD like this. While it could be seen as unfair to the owners to change the building's status from non-contributory now, it's far better for due process that both the City and Lovell Chen are now able to repair the initial error that was made when looking at the building, which Lovell Chen subsequently changed in their decision-making. We'd also just like to restate again that contributory status on this site will not be anything against the owner or even against development, as there's clear opportunity here to keep important elements of this streetscape, perhaps the front 5 metres of the building and a bit of the laneway frontage. Set back with a new development or a rooftop extension, we can have a development here on the site that respects both the precinct and the evolution of the city. I think this is actually a pretty good place to do that. So hopefully we can, hopefully you can change the recommendation and include this building in alongside the other Guildford Lane and Hardware Lane buildings that you're putting towards the minister. And we can see this precinct maintain, you know, the character it currently has, which is a great asset to the city.
Thanks, Tristan.
Thank you.
Are there questions for Tristan? No. Thank you, though. We will now move to Wayne Coles-Janice, if he is here. Yes, thanks, Wayne. You have up to 3 minutes. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Lord Mayor and Councillor. I would like to endorse the Melbourne Heritage Association's or Action Group's recommendations for the protection and for Charter House. And I'd also like to ask the council and councillors what we can do to protect the heritage of the Central Business District, because it seems to be a reoccurring problem and it seems to consume a considerable amount of time for both the council, councillors, and people that are aware of what is happening to the city. A lot of people aren't aware of what changes or what buildings are going to be demolished until it's too late. And we've seen the amazing building proposed for South Bank. It's only through contrast that people can really appreciate both the new and the old. And we certainly need to have buildings that contribute more than just architectural splendour in the CBD, and also document the changing nature of architecture in its styles, use, form and function. So rather than repeat a lot of things, I'd really like to hear from the council, what can Melbourne City Council do to protect the last remaining vestiges of heritage buildings, whether they be contributory or not contributory, whether they be altered, because it's not just the buildings themselves. A building like Charter House, or as we saw last year, Melbourne House, offers a variety of tenancies for businesses within the Melbourne CBD area, and they also are an important historic record to where we have come from a city and where we may go. And maybe Councillor Leppard, could I ask you to maybe lead in on what you believe we can do as a council and as a community to protect our architectural heritage? Thank you.
I assure you I'll make remarks to that end during the debate, but thank you very much. Are there any questions for Wayne at this stage? No, thank you. You may take a seat. There was no one else who wished to address the committee, is that right? No, I wasn't sure. Thank you very much. I'm going to move the motion in the form of the recommendation from management, and thank you, Councillor Rees, for seconding the motion. Let me explain why I'm doing that. But let me start by starting where the submitters have started, which is to acknowledge that this is not the panel members' greatest work. I don't think that the panel member came to the right conclusion, but I'm not sure that a different conclusion would have been arrived at had some of the areas that we've identified been picked up. I really don't know. But there are three pretty fundamental issues with the panel report that I found. One is pretty obvious. There's a big yellow section there saying insert discussion about practice planning practice note one, which is about applying the heritage overlay here, and obviously that didn't happen. That raised my shackles. Is that the phrase? Yes. Secondly, I think Tristan, you brought this up. The panel member was very reliant on some evidence from Lovell Chen about the alteration of the building, citing that as a reason that the building should be non-contributory, even though Lovell Chen was arguing in conclusion that it should be graded contributory. So the panel member was possibly choosing the wrong argument there. And thirdly, I think Tristan's touched on this as well, there's no comparative analysis. If you're looking at whether or not to grade a building contributory inside a precinct study, you'd think you'd have a look at some of the other buildings to see how the building matches up against other contributory or non-contributory buildings, and that didn't appear to happen. The panel member's taken quite a narrow view of what his role was, and he's concluded that there should be an HO, but the building should be graded non-contributory. Now, while I disagree with that, we've got to remember why we asked this panel process to be set up again. When we went through the Guildford and Hardware Lane review process, it came to council, and we saw that the Little Bourke Street precinct, which is perpendicular to the other laneways that we're actually trying to build precincts around, didn't quite have a study of its own. It didn't look like the precinct of Little Bourke Street proper had been fully thought through. So we amended the motion that came to us based on Lovell Chen's work, and we asked that Melbourne House and Chart House and a few other buildings be included at the consent of the professionals, Lovell Chen, and Lovell Chen did reassess their work based on the new parameters we set them, and they included quite a few buildings. Not Chart House, not Melbourne House. Melbourne House we've dealt with on a separate occasion, and that's another sorry story of its own, and let's not re-prosecute that. The new, and so we already have had a few bites of the cherry here. We adopted that amendment post-panel, but the new information that came via Melbourne Heritage Action, and thank you very much for your vigilance in providing all of this new information 6 months earlier, and perhaps this would be another story, but thank you regardless. And we thought, look, there's new information here. We need to ask this question again. Throughout this period, though, this constant shopping and changing and re-asking the question, what should the grading of this building be, we've been asking an applicant for a planning application on this very site to wait until we keep asking this question until we get the answer that we like. We've made it very clear that this was our last go at trying to answer that question. I don't agree with the panel member, but it would be churlish of us to continue to ask the same question until we get the answer that we think we really want. I'm really disappointed with where we've got here, where we've landed here, but this is the process we've set up, and I think we need to follow it through and close down this very lengthy, extraordinarily expensive process for some parties, including the City of Melbourne, but of course also the planning applicant. But finally, and most importantly, and I'll pick up on what Wayne said here, we have to keep sight of the bigger picture. We can't disagree with every single planning panel recommendation that comes to us. The most important that we've got on the Minister's desk at the moment is C258, which changes the gradings of thousands of properties in the City of Melbourne. Until that is gazetted, we can't do the Hoddle Grid Heritage Review, which we commissioned 3.5 years ago now, which we've already adopted in principle and which we're just waiting for C258 to be adopted. The longer we argue with the Planning Minister about the details of what is, yes, a significant building, but in the grand scheme of things is only going to slow down the progress of the Hoddle Grid Heritage Review, which, let's remember, has lots of buildings that don't have an HO at all that we'd like to get protection for. And then there are other cabs off the rank after that. I won't list them all here in case there are any developers in the room. No, just kidding. We've got to keep sight of the bigger picture. So in fairness to all parties involved, despite the planning panel report errors, and I think there are significant errors there, but in light of the bigger picture, which is the protection of everything that the community values as significant in our heritage fabric in the central city, I think we need to go with the recommendation from management today, as difficult though that is. Councillor Rees.
Thanks, Councillor Lippitt. Look, I share your disappointment, sorrow and anger, frankly, at the panel decision. And like you, I grudgingly acknowledge it is what it is. I know the procedural realities of where we now find ourselves and agree that we have to move on, basically. I was very concerned when we considered Melbourne House some 2 years or so ago, like Wayne and I know many others. I thought that was a building that deserved a higher heritage grading. In the end, I yielded to the advice of the experts, I've got to say it's one of the most painful decisions I've had to make as a councillor. Equally, I had concerns about the original grading of Chart House. We've been through a long process, and that's ended up in a place which I think is also equally unfortunate. And there's no doubt about it. When you put Melbourne House together with Chart House and what is likely to happen on those sites, this is going to be a favourite little corner of Melbourne, which is never going to be the same again, and Melbourne is going to lose a little bit of its charm. I think the other thing that's important for us to all acknowledge is that heritage significance is not just about beauty and aesthetics. It can be about the historical or social significance of a location, and it tells the story of the changing uses of the city. And in particular, I thought Chart House is particularly of great interest because it's being used by map makers, government officers, it was a warehouse, now it's hotels. So it very much tells the story of our city. And that whole precinct through there is really a beautiful example of that sort of end of the Victorian era through to that sort of interwar period. And now it's a big part of it is going to be lost. So it's not with any... Well, it's with a sense of sorrow, really, that I second this motion.
Thanks, Councillor Rees. Any other contributors to this debate, sorrowful or not? Let me close the debate just by mentioning that people are saying a contributory grading will equal protection. I just want to make the point that that's not necessarily the case. A case can be mounted to demolish a contributory graded building, and I'm not going to second guess what an application would or would not do, but it's not automatic protection. By the same token, though, a non-contributory grading within a heritage overlay is still going to require a future built form to be a bit more adaptive and responsive to the heritage precinct than were there no overlay there. So it's a bit more nuanced than protection equals no demolition and some of the debates we've seen. I just thought I'd make that point. But I will now definitely put the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. Thank you. I declare that carried unanimously. And I'll hand over to the Lord Mayor to chair the remainder of the meeting.
Thank you, Councillor Lippitt. Thank you very much. This concludes reports from management this evening. Councillors, we're noting that there are no items of general business for consideration this evening. Are there any items of urgent business for consideration this evening? No. Then that brings us to our public questions. In the final 15 minutes of our meeting, we allow time for questions. And if you do have questions, could you please raise your hand? We'll ask you to come to the podium. Can you please give us your name? Peter Kelly. Peter Kelly, thank you. Are there any other questioners this evening? Stephen Main and Wayne. All right, that's it. I can't see. Chris, did you have any other questions? Not tonight. Okay. Peter, fire away, and then Stephen, and then Wayne. Thanks so much.
I was at a residents' meeting in Greenbar last Thursday, and there was a member of Hume Council there, and I asked him about ghost permits. And he changed the subject very quickly. And I'm awfully concerned about ghost permits in the Melbourne City Council to jack up the price of property for sale.
Peter, I'm looking to our chair of our property portfolio to respond to that.
Thanks.
Lord Mayor. So I agree it is a policy challenge here in the City of Melbourne. For those not familiar with ghost permits, it refers to the process of landowners essentially applying for applications that they have no intention of actually following through on. They do it to increase the value of the site and then move it on. while I acknowledge the potential harm that can do to the public good, I would say that's a very, very difficult area to regulate.
It's only a form of greed because the people who own it are using a deviant process to encourage a higher price.
Mm. I don't know that we can pass laws that outlaw greed, vile as human greed is. If you've got some ideas about possible policy interventions or levers that are available to the City of Melbourne to better regulate or prevent the ghost permit process, I'm very, right, very open to them. So while I acknowledge the social and economic problem you've identified, I'm not sure what the policy solution is, but look, maybe we can have a conversation offline. I'm open to any other ideas that other councils here wish to proffer.
I'll be in contact and I'll watch what happens about policy makers who present it to council.
Thank you, and thank you for your contribution this evening.
Thanks, Peter. Good conversation to have. Stephen Main, over to you.
Lord Mayor, first up, councillors should be aware that from 8 o'clock tonight up at the Legislative Council, it's the local government bill on for young and old, probably for the next 2 to 4 hours. It's fascinating stuff. I've been watching it all day, so I'd invite you to
We'd better hurry. We've got to get up there. Wow.
Come up there, because it's lonely. There's no one else in the public gallery.
Is it live streamed? Is it?
I'll give you the summary later.
Okay.
The local government bill. So the whole laws are related to local government. So, but
run both City of Melbourne FMC and Spring Street on two screens.
It's a great too much day local for government, never enough. Politics, so. I've got two questions tonight. The first one is I'd like to ask the Lord Mayor why she attended the page 13 gossip column lunch in the city of Yarra, which the Herald Sun put on recently as a sort of a power flexing exercise. The Herald Sun and News Corp are at the core of climate change denialism. They rubbish local government all the time, but they like to project they have all this power and they stand over politicians. They like to invite them along and then tell the world, look at this crowd that we can draw. Now, I know we've spoken before and you've talked about not playing media favourites, so I'd just like to ask you why you did attend that, given the position of the whole company and the whole paper, and whether you would go to other, a Guardian lunch in Williamstown. You know, would you go to that, or is the Herald Sun just this super powerful group that you must bow at their feet?
Stephen, thanks for your question. I don't believe the Herald Sun is a superpower group, but I do acknowledge the Herald Sun, who aren't always nice to me either, Stephen, are an important stakeholder in our city. The invitation came from the chair and the editor as part of welcoming, what do you call it, the senior editor, as part of welcoming the new editor, Sam Weir, to Melbourne and the Melbourne community, and an opportunity for him to be introduced to various people from across Melbourne. And I think that's a good thing. As I said, I think they're an important stakeholder in our city and play various roles from time to time. There was also a fundraising element to the lunch, to which I contributed to raising money for bushfires. And I think that, you know, it's important to be able to participate in those sorts of events. I go to events in lots of different municipalities where there are worthwhile conversations, stakeholders to meet, and opportunities to continue to promote the interests of the City of Melbourne, and that's what I did.
Okay, thank you. My second question was the annual report last year did not disclose the pay arrangements for the former CEO, Ben Rimmer. I think it probably should have. We had the current CEO's salary and contract. We had the next five most senior. But it's silent on the question of the former CEO. So I'd like to ask you, Lord Mayor, when the former CEO exited, did he just exit with the strict terms of his contract, or did the councillors agree to any ex gratia, larger exit payments? And if so, can you give us the detail of those?
Well, I'll have to look at Keith, but my understanding was that it was a confidential item and therefore sharing any of the details in terms of the latter part of your question would be inappropriate. It's a staff matter, if you like. Often these matters, you probably know more about this than I do, Stephen, are considered confidential for, I think, very valid reasons as people move forward in their lives and as we come to arrangements. So thank you for your question, but that is my understanding. Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? Sorry, Wayne, you said you had another one, so come on up. Thanks.
Just quickly a little bit about some of the proposed works for Elizabeth Street, and I note that bicycle path and infrastructure has been going in some areas, namely William Street. Unfortunately, being a cyclist myself, I quite often notice that, the road surfaces are very unfriendly towards cycles, and also a lot of the bike paths that do exist, and I'll make specific reference to William Street, goes nowhere. So quite often you'll have bike paths or stuff, and then it'll go into the next intersection, will be into a line of parked cars, or there won't be any. Another good spot is down on South Bank when you're turning. There's no room for the cyclists and the pedestrians to go. And I was just wondering where the Melbourne City Council is on their timetable for the installation or the improvement of bicycle infrastructure and the Elizabeth Street and upgrades, and also the mention of the little streets, Little Burke, Little Collins, etc., and where they do, because we all know that pedestrian space and footpaths is becoming very cramped for everyone.
Excellent. Can I just clarify, were there three elements to that? One was bike paths, two was the Elizabeth Street upgrades at the Flinders Street end, was it? And three
was the little... how bicycle little. Paths.
Okay, well, I'm going to hand over to our Chair of Transport, Councillor Nick Francis-Gilley.
Hi, Wayne. Thanks for the question. I think specifically on Elizabeth Street, if you do have a question, we might take it at the end and respond to you with some detail rather than do it specifically here. Generally speaking, we've got, I guess, a few things going on. One is that we're recognising that to increase the use of cycle paths, we really have to keep them separated from other traffic. And so we've committed over the next 10 years to 70 kilometres of that. Under last week or the week before, we committed to bringing 40 kilometres of that forward into the next 4 years as part of our climate change action strategy. I think in terms of your comment about where cycle paths suddenly disappear or don't work. Certainly one of the big areas that was a case was on Exhibition Street, and we've got a big commitment to change that, and we're starting that work straight away. I think the other thing that we do as a team is that we recognise each year, we write down and say, okay, where are the places where those problems are happening? We draw up a list of those hot spots, if you like, where literally things stop, don't go anywhere and fail, and we then target those as our priority areas. And as well as drawing up that list ourselves, we also then have conversations with some relevant parties like Bicycle Network and others to say, this is our hotspot list, does it make sense to you? So we are trying to clean them up. We do have a way of doing it. We are trying to do that in relationship with those people that know. And more broadly, we're really trying to rapidly build infrastructure that makes it much easier and much safer for more people to cycle.
Okay.
I think that's probably the answer. There is an opportunity with the little streets, as we outlined in the transport strategy, to do a range of things. So to slow them down, to move them for cycling, to actually increase them for, you know, well, pedestrians or eating or doing a whole range of stuff. So I think we may see the little streets pick up some of the heavy lifting on cycling or may not. I think that's part of the opportunity that we've got through the strategy over the next 10 years.
Okay.
Thank you for the question. Great question.
But
I was just going to add, just to agree what Councillor Francis Gillu was saying in terms of the team being really excellent at understanding where the hotspots are in the city and working towards sort of fixing. But even just little annoyances that you might have on your ride, you should document them and send them in, because the intel is really useful, and I can assure you that they look at them and you know, and obviously where possible and within reason, they certainly address it. So
all right. Any other questions? Been very interesting. Thanks to everyone for participating. Oh, here we go. Tristan, come on up.
Sorry, that was a bit last minute. Just while I'm here, though, thought I'd ask a question, I think, related to the arts portfolio in Melbourne. Just because I think over the last 5 or 10 years, similar to the housing affordability crisis, we've seen a lot of art spaces disappear from the CBD of Melbourne and the city of Melbourne in general. Just off the top of my head, I can think of the entire Guildford Lane Arts Precinct is now cafes and apartments. We've seen spaces like King's Artist Run Space recently closed down, and other spaces in Chinatown, and also West Space for that matter, which was in a City of Melbourne property, which has now been redeveloped up on Bourke Street. And also we're seeing the Campbell Arcade redevelopment for Metro, seeing a number of art spaces like Sticky Institute disappear from there. So really at the moment, if the Nicholas building fell over one day, we wouldn't have a single underground or non-commercial art space really in the CBD of Melbourne. Well, I hope so. So I'm just wondering if there's any strategies to deal with affordability in that sense, and sort of the way that we call ourselves a creative city, but that might be slipping away in terms of spaces that are for used.
Good question, thank you. And I'm going to defer to, I love having all these chairs of portfolios, Rohan Leppert to respond.
Thanks, Tristan. The short answer is yes, but of course it's extremely difficult. But first of all, yes, I agree. If the Nicholas building, for whatever reason, stopped functioning as an artist space, that would be the single most devastating thing that would happen to the creative life of this city. It is the most important creative hub, public or private, in this city, and it is absolutely extraordinary what happens in that building. It is privately operated, and obviously there are risks involved in that. In an ideal world, perhaps there'd be a role for government there, but I desperately hope that that building and that hub will remain for a very, very, very long time. Yes, the city is experiencing record disruption at the moment with record development, and that means that as some spaces close down, other spaces might open, but it's not always predictable and reliable to know how many spaces are going to be available for artists and where. And you'll often find that when government seeks to curate the occupancy of spaces by certain types of artists, these things are destined to fail. That aside, we do have a creative spaces program which is very successful. This financial year, we have an annual plan initiative which is looking at reviewing the scope of the Creative Spaces program to see if we should be expanding it next year within the central city. We recently lost the Boyd Classrooms, which was our most central city part of the directly operated Creative Spaces program. We've still got the Guild, which is a bit of a hybrid model, and we've still got River Studios, but that's outside the city. So we are currently actively looking at what the role of council is in the Creative Spaces place. The mission of the Creative Spaces program is to provide affordable spaces for artists to practice. And so all I can say at this stage is watch this space. We're still halfway through the review. By the end of the financial year, hopefully we can chat again.
Thanks. Good to know. Thanks.
I think it's watch this creative space. Great question, because having debated tonight the draft affordable housing strategy so that people can afford to live here, we need to make sure they still have places to work as well, and that's why that review is recommended for this year's APIs. Thank you. Terrific participation and contribution to our question time. Great topics, and gives us a good indication of what people feel passionate about, as I said earlier tonight. This brings us, I think, yes, to the end of our meeting. Thanks to the public management staff for your interest and attendance this evening. And we are declaring the meeting closed at 7:53. Thanks, everyone.